We're starting a show now called The Mystic Pete Chronicles, and I'm Mystic Pete. Every week, through interviews with thought leaders, visionaries, and creatives, and stories, music, and humor, we'll do some deep ponders in this time of great change, and have some fun. If you'd like more information about today's guests, or to be interviewed for the show yourself, I'm at mysticpete.com. Today we're going deep. This show is about death and dying. We start, as always, with the extraordinary Mike Bone and his story called Willis Jackson Bone. Then I do an extended interview with Lynn-Ann McGrail, who's an end-of-life doula. And then a story by me, Mystic Pete, Judith's story. Stay tuned.
There were two newspapers in Macon when I was growing up. The Macon News was the afternoon newspaper, and the Macon Telegraph was the morning paper. In 1974, the two newspapers merged into the Macon Telegraph and News. The name changed to just the Macon Telegraph in 1990. We got the Macon paper every day, but on Sundays, Dad would buy the Atlanta Journal-Constitution. Their slogan was, "Covers Dixie like the dew." It was a more robust paper, and it had a great magazine section. When I was about 10 years old, there was a story in the Atlanta Journal-Constitution magazine section about Crystal Lake, one of the most beautiful bodies of water in all of South Georgia, near the Alapaha River in Irwin County, Georgia. It was a great story about this spring-fed, icy lake that had no water flowing into the lake and no water flowing out of the lake. The 100-acre natural Crystal Lake was operated as a water park with swimming, dancing, bowling, skating, water slides, and more. Then, buried in the article, was the story about how Crystal Lake used to be called Bone Lake. Some man named Willis Jackson Bone had owned it and had been hanged there. I mentioned this to my father, and his response was, "Yes, that was your great-great-great-grandfather." Wow! I was flabbergasted. Willis Jackson Bone and I share a birthday and two-thirds of a name. He owned and operated a grist mill in Irwin County, Georgia, during the Civil War. As a miller, he was exempt from having to serve in the Confederate Army. A community must have a miller to stay alive. He had moved to Irwin County from Elberton, Georgia, in the northeast part of the state, in 1858. He was an anti-war, pro-unionist activist. Needless to say, he did not have a lot of friends in Irwin County. In mid-February 1865, a group of Southern Unionists and a large number of residents and deserters led by Willis Jackson Bone assembled in Irwinville. The group passed a resolution declaring the county's return to the Union. Three cheers for Abraham Lincoln followed. Confederate sympathizers were chased out of town and threatened with death if they returned. Grandfather knew how to win friends and influence people. Not. The Emancipation Proclamation was issued on January the 1st, 1863. In early April 1865, my grandfather gave work to a former slave named Big Tony. A local justice of the peace, Jack Walker, saw Big Tony working on grandfather's land and attempted to tie him up to return him to his owner. A scuffle ensued. Grandfather shot and killed Mr. Walker. It should be noted that Mr. Walker was on grandfather's land carrying a gun. When Mr. Walker did not return home, his family went searching for him. When the search party arrived at grandfather's mill, allegedly the family seemed nervous. They separated the family and threatened to hang Willis Jackson's son, Zachariah Taylor Bone, age 15. He was also known as ZT, If ZT did not tell what he knew about the incident, there is also some documentation that ZT was tortured to make him talk. ZT told the search party what had happened and where the body was buried. It seems that Mr. Walker was not dead when he was buried. He tried to dig out of his grave. Searchers found one of Walker's hands reaching out of the mud. Justice in South Georgia was certain, sudden, and severe in 1865. Once Mr. Walker's body was found, a local Baptist minister and former judge, Jacob Young, organized a court of justice and proceeded to try Grandfather. He was convicted and sentenced to be hung that day. Appeal? What appeal? A scaffold was erected at the edge of the pond under a large oak tree. Ropes were scarce in those days. There was a war going on. A local woman, Mrs. Hogan, had spun and woven a rope to be used on a bale of cotton. It was this rope that was used to hang Grandfather. His last words were allegedly, "Take warning from me and don't come to what I have." Willis Jackson Bone was hanged near Bone Pond on April 20, 1865. Willis Jackson was buried near the northwest corner of Bone Pond. His widow, Sarah, was notified to wind up their affairs, dispose of their property, and move out of the county. The land, 1,280 acres of it, was appraised at $600 and was sold for $90. There went the Bone family plantation. The Civil War ended 3 weeks later on May 13, 1865. Bone Pond became Crystal Lake and operated as a local swimming resort until the 1990s.
This is Mystic Pete. It is November 20th, 2020. I have Lynn Ann McGrail in studio, and she is a death doula. Hi, Lynn Ann.
Hello, Pete. How are you?
Great. I think we should start out by you explaining what a death doula is.
Absolutely. I actually call myself an end-of-life doula, which is the same thing as a death doula. People will often ask, like, what is even a doula? And a doula is the Greek word that means a non-medical person who provides emotional, mental, and spiritual support. And people will relate to a birthing doula. You know, when you're giving birth, they have a midwife or a birthing doula there. This is the same thing, only it's at the other end of life. So as an end-of-life doula, I'm trained in the various stages associated with end-of-life and able to assist the dying individual and their family to both understand and manage this very natural life process of death with grace and ease and as much peace as possible, while also providing comfort and support for them.
Sounds like a very important, helpful practice that is probably present in a lot of different cultures, but is very new to ours.
Well, it's interesting you say that, because really, if we did a survey, hospice did a survey, where they asked people where would they like to die, and 92% said they want to die at home. And what that means is that back in the tribal days, when the community and the family and the loved ones all came together and supported this person at home in the comfort of their bed, surrounded by their pets and their personal things, and provided support in their transition. And then through the years, that tribal way of dying sort of fell by the wayside, and it became like this medical model of dying. So you go to the hospital, then you go to a nursing home, and then you die in a nursing home. And so this whole end-of-life movement, if you will, is about bringing back that tribal way. It's about being present and fully actively holding space with somebody, with their family, with their loved ones, with the church community, their neighbors, surrounding this person at home so they can die with peace of mind. And I just love that you bring that up, because it is a very tribal way of being, and it's nothing new. What we do is nothing new. They just added a name to it, and now some of us get paid to do it. Not very much, but we get paid.
I am a healer, and I've worked with death and dying. And I'm sure when you even bring up this topic, people want to share stories. There's so much emotion, and it's so charged, and so, it's such an important part of life. that is really not talked about much. Part of the reason why I wanted you on my show, I want to start the conversation on radio. But what comes to mind to me, so here I am wanting to immediately share something about my personal story, but this is to lead into the next question. My dad in his mid-90s had suffered terrible decline in health, and he was just very little left. And I told his caregivers and my mom, if he's going, let him go. He didn't want to be here. He was terribly depressed. He wanted to go. It was obvious. But he was had some kind of incident, and he actually died, but they called the paramedics, and they resuscitated him, carted him off in an ambulance to the emergency room. Like, this huge trauma surrounded what was kind of a definite and simple process. So it turned it into alarm and craziness. And he could have actually been on a breathing machine for months had not some wise emergency room doctor decided to not do it. So we are in this traumatized situation around death, and we panic, and suddenly there's the paramedics, or you're in a nursing home far away. There's a lot of crazy making, but how do we distinguish when it's like right to get medicine involved from when we're just supposed to let nature take its course? That's the question I was getting to.
Yeah, well, this is a great question, and it starts off with conversation. To have what it is that we would all like to have for peace of mind at end of life starts with a conversation. It starts with understanding what it is that you, me, personally want to have happen at the end of life. So it's really about, I mean, I hate to bring up healthcare directives and get all, you know, legal mumbo jumbo, but the truth is that if we can get prepared for what we want at end of life and then articulate what that want is, and then you designate a healthcare proxy who's going to fulfill what it is that you've chosen for your end of life, then at the end of the day, when that day comes, and it will for all of us, we are prepared. They can go back to that paper and say, hey, you know what? Lynanne doesn't want to be put on a machine. She wants quality of life, not quantity of life. And so having it on paper is the gift that you can give your family and your loved ones so that they know how to fulfill what your wishes are. And I think that's the most important thing, is having these conversations. But you know what? People are scared to death to have conversation. They're afraid that if they talk about death, that it's going to happen. And that's like saying, well, if I talk about babies, I'm going to get pregnant. You know, that's just not true. So having the conversation around it first is utmost key. I mean, as an end-of-life doula, I've had the opportunities to be with one family that wasn't prepared and a family that was. And the family that wasn't prepared were the ones that never talked about it. They swept it under the rug. It's not going to happen to my loved one. There's a lot of denial. And then at the end of the day, in that 11th hour, crisis mode happens. And now you're making all these really, really tough decisions in a stressful time. And it can all be avoided by talking about it ahead of time. And when you talk about it ahead of time, then everybody knows about it. Everybody knows what to expect. There's no surprises. And then the transition can come with much more peace. And so being able to see the difference between the two of those has been, you know, really a gift in my understanding of how to help prepare people in getting prepared for end of life.
I just learned something, because I had told everyone no extraordinary measures. What I just learned from you is it should have really been a conversation, not just me top down. I should have like had everybody discuss their feelings about it so everybody could vent and come to an agreement, not just somebody telling them what to do. So, okay, I've learned right there.
Yeah, ideally the person who is the one who's been terminally diagnosed and is the one that's transitioning has prepared ahead of time so that you and the family would know exactly what to do. But if that doesn't happen, and it's very often the case, like your own, where now the family is trying to make that decision, and there have been fights and arguments and breakups over whether to keep mom on a machine or not. And it can be, you know, it's sad to see and it's avoidable, but it is, you know, part of reality that some people just don't want to face it.
And we quickly get into the religious and political sphere. So what you're talking about earlier is an advance directive. And this is where you put on paper exactly what you want to happen at the end. And there's other legal documents. But, you know, a hospital is going to want to see that. Otherwise, you're in a critical situation. There's a lot of confusion. And everybody's panicked over getting lawsuits, doctors and hospitals. And any, you know, so when it's clearly written, it avoids chaos. Let's talk a little about the general situation of bedside work. That's one of the things a death doula or end-of-life caregiver does.
Sure. When, for example, I'll use a client that I'm working with now. About 7 months ago, her son contacted me and asked me if I would provide some support for his mom. And she was in a board and care. And it's actually a little bit longer than that, because pre-COVID, I was able to actually go into the facility and be with her bedside. And by bedside, it's literally bedside. You're pulling up a chair next to the person and sitting bedside with them. Given the situation with her, she wanted to talk. She wanted to share stories with me. She wanted to express some concerns she had about dying. We talked about her fear about dying, and being able to just be an ear. You know, I have my master's in spiritual psychology. I've been a life coach for several years. And so being able to tap into all of my prior experiences and skills, I can help guide her through that fear, help her get to that other side where she can then find peace. Sometimes the patient isn't wanting to talk. Sometimes they can't talk. They're too sick. So you literally hold space. And some people don't know exactly what that means. So holding space is, for me, and this, my definition of it is breathing in consciously, mindfully, while with the person, grounding my energy within the space that they are sitting. And so enveloping them in the energy of unconditional love for their highest good and for the highest good of all those around them. And so in this space, holding them exactly where they're at, not trying to make anything better or different, letting them know that where they are is the perfect space to be, that they're not judged for the way that they're being right now, and being fully present with them. Oftentimes, they like to have just the air filled with noise. So I'll read a book. I'll read poems. I will rub their hands. I'll rub their feet. And I'm often asking the caregiver to have them leave the room so they can get a break. Because oftentimes caregiving is exhausting work. And what we try to do as end-of-life doula is to get in there before what they call compassion fatigue sets in. So when a person has been taking care of someone for so long, like my father, who died of Alzheimer's, he had the disease for 7 years. It's a very long, drawn-out process. And many people are familiar with it and have experienced the same thing. But after a while, his wife, who was taking care of him, started to get like, okay, I'm getting ready for you to go. And to even have that thought brought on such guilt. And then with the guilt brings anger, and with the anger brings resentment, and now you're starting to feel exhausted. And that's the compassion fatigue that we're talking about. So as an end-of-life doula or death doulas, coming in and just holding space and letting that person leave for a little while, go recharge your batteries, take a walk, read a book, go to the mall, whatever is going to make you feel better so that you can come back and continue to take care of the person that you love. And so explaining that to the caregivers, that it's okay to have those emotions and those feelings, and that I'm here to help them as much as I'm there to help their loved one as well.
Beautifully put. I've even seen something even more complicated, kind of a caregiving mania at times. It's almost like they can't let go. You could see the caregiver is in a bad place, but they're also kind of obsessed. I don't know. It can get complicated.
Well, death is complicated because we make it that way. You know, we overthink it, we analyze it, we dissect it. When we can let go and slow down, you know, like the people who don't want to let go and feel like they're going to run themselves in the ground taking care of people. And I can understand that. I can understand that because they feel that they're the best ones to take care of that person. They don't want anybody else interfering. They don't know how to take care of my person. This is my loved one, not yours. And almost like martyrdom, but at the same time, you know, it could lead to such exhaustion for them. And for somebody coming in like myself, it's more about listening to people when they're in that space. Like, okay, I'm going to reflect back to you what you're sharing with me, and does it still feel good? And oftentimes it doesn't, so they're willing to shift it a little bit.
Yeah, and I think there is a close relationship between beginning of life and end of life at times. In terms of like a very old person is kind of in an infantilized place. And if you think about babies, though, they're cuddly and cooing and cute and they smell nice usually. And everybody wants to be around a baby. And they're helpless. But very old people, they may be helpless too. But they may be difficult or angry, or they may smell bad. They may have urination or defecation issues. They may be in pain. They may have a communicable disease. So I think the shine that comes with very young people may not be present with the very old. And I do think it takes a very special patience to want to deal with people in that situation who are very old and maybe having a lot of different problems.
Absolutely. I mean, it does take a very unique individual. Not everybody wants to be in that role. But it's I think a lot of it just comes from my own connection to spirit, my own connection to Mother Earth, you know, just to be able to see these beautiful elderly, hopefully elderly, sometimes they're not so old, people in their journey, seeing them as their whole life, seeing them as this wonderful being that has spent a lot of time on this planet, and who knows how many lives that person has touched. So seeing them in that light, yeah, you're going to get a poopy diaper here and there, and, you know, you kind of make fun or laugh about it, and, you know, everybody's farting together, and we're all getting out the sprays and making the room smell better. And being able to find humor in it is also really important, you know. It's to see it as a natural process of life, and to know that we each and every one of us are going to do it, whether we like it or not, allows me to stay in that space and hold it for them, especially for the family members who aren't able to hold it, you know, who aren't able to be there because it is so uncomfortable for them.
Well, let's expand the conversation a little bit. I think, again, some cultures, death is just a part of life. Killing and butchering animals for dinner may be done right next to where you live, and you're used to seeing animals be killed, or you may go out and kill animals. This is animal world. And then people who are dying, they're in the house with you, and you just become used to this process as a young person growing up, and it's not separated. The people aren't sent off someplace. You may even have the remains of the burial in the yard, or even mummified remains in the next room in certain tribal cultures. So it's a part of living. Now we're estranged from death. It's far off. It's sanitized. The death and dying process is all like someplace else and done by somebody else. Burial by professionals. We're so separated from this necessary ultimate component of living. Let's talk about that a little, and death and its meaning. And how people can relax a little more and include it a little bit more in their consciousness.
Yeah, I think a lot of that is, again, goes back to having conversations around it. You know, once a month, at the beginning of the month, I hold what's called a death cafe. I don't know if you've ever heard of that. It's a
death cafe. I had a punk band called that when I was a teenager.
Really?
It's a joke.
What a great name. I love it. Yeah. A death cafe is an opportunity for like-minded people who want to talk about death, but because our society doesn't, they feel at a loss. You know, they know that it's a natural part of life and that, you know, like the tribal days, it's just part of who we are. But when we're together in a forum that we have permission to talk about it, oh my goodness, what a rich and enlightening conversations we have around it. And people will talk about their curiosity around it. They'll talk about their experiences. They'll talk about situations that are happening with them real time in their life. And it's a self-guided group, and people just are open to share if they want to share or not share. And I think, you know, starting with places like that, bringing death back to the table, allowing people to talk about it and letting them know that it's okay is a good starting point. You know, I think trying to right the wrongs around how society views it is kind of like an uphill battle. If we can just step into it from our own heart space, having conversations like you and I and you doing these wonderful interviews around it is another great starting point. It's just letting people know that it truly is okay to talk about it. And it's funny what happens when you talk about it, you become a little bit more comfortable around it. And the more you become more comfortable around it, then you can start to feel better and prepared for it. And once we do prepare for it, we have that advanced care directive and our healthcare proxies, it's like you can start living. It's like starting to live life fully because now you understand that, you know, we don't know if we're here tomorrow. We don't know if we're here next week. But we do know we're here right now. And how are we living in our moment right now? Are we happy? Do we have joy? Are we content in our life? Do we have a job that we love? Are we in a relationship where we feel loved? And so talking about death can bring us all to these, you know, really rich moments of really falling back and living the life we really want.
I love how you're connecting these dots between reflecting on death and finding a meaningful life. I'm talking to Lynn Ann McGrail. You are at apeacefultransitionla.com. And let's talk a little about religion now and how that figures into your practice.
Well, my religion is like Gandhi's. It's called kindness. And I always love to say that. You know, people will ask me, do I know how to be with someone who's Catholic or someone who's Jewish? You know, the truth of the matter is, I see the person exactly where they're coming from. If a person wants to have somebody who has a Jewish background, I do not have a Jewish background. I know people who do have a Jewish background that are end-of-life doulas that can be with that person if they specifically want certain things understood or certain things read to them. You know, for me, if a person is atheist, for example, doesn't even believe in God or believe in religion, that once their body goes, that's it, they're done, then it's not my role to convince them otherwise. So really meeting the person where they're at is the perfect place for me to stand. To convince them otherwise would be an uphill battle, and that wouldn't serve them in any way. It's also not about me. You know, if they want to not believe in God or have a specific religion that they prefer, then that's fine. That's completely up to them. You know, I don't not ever work with somebody because of their religious beliefs.
That wisely put. And I think, of course, religious conversion or conversation is perhaps a whole different topic, although we're also right up against it. Like, some religions, well, if you've been good, you go to heaven. If you've been bad, you go to, like, this is where that whole thing happens you might have been working your whole life for.
Right. Well, if I were to share my vision of what death is in religion, you know, I I believe that because of my spiritual psychology background, that each one of us prior to coming down into this human body, we call, you know, I call it a spacesuit. It's like this suit we put on that wraps around our spirit. We have chosen a spiritual curriculum, if you will, that we need to fulfill while we're here in these bodies. And as we go through our lives and bump up against our experiences, we satisfy what that curriculum is. Now, it's not the same for every person. In fact, it's very different for every person. So for me to meet up with somebody and try to, not fix them, but to have them see things a different way, then that would be going against what their spiritual curriculum is all about. And so seeing that this is their journey, and this is they're here for their purpose, and I'm here for my purpose as you are here for yours, allows me to completely let go of anything that's happening within my own consciousness and see them from where they're at. I also know that once we leave this body, we're not really dead. My brother, who died at 13, still is very much alive inside my heart. I just need to close my eyes, be still for a minute, call him forward for me, and I get a whoosh over my body that lets me know he's with me and guides me throughout my day. As my 32-year-old niece, who recently passed, I call upon her to help me through some tough times, to help me through anxiousness that may come up, and I literally feel her with me. So that's my perspective on it. I believe that we're spiritual beings having a human experience, and that's kind of how I go forward in my life around the concept of religion and dying.
Such an important point. So death, to some people, is where it all just ends and turns blank. But to a lot of people, it's where they turn into angels or they go to heaven. So it's, in a sense, the zenith of life. So at the same time, it's the height and the depth of our existence. You know what I mean? And death is, we're scared of it. It can be painful. It can be terrifying. Every horror movie has something to do with death going on in it. So the plot thickens. The work of the death doula, there's just a lot of different conversations happening. And, changing the topic a little bit, I think one way that people encounter death, probably the most common way, is through the death of a pet. And I don't know if people have never been really close to a dog or a cat or any kind of animal, they may not realize the depth of the relationship that happens. And I've counseled people, I've talked to people, and they're telling me about their dog that died when they were 15, and tears come to their eyes, and now they're 50. It's a profound experience of loss, losing a beloved pet. I don't know, does this figure into your work at all?
Well, it's interesting you say that. I just had a great conversation with a grief coach who specializes in pet loss, and a fascinating individual. But, you know, the grief is grief, and loss is loss. And a lot of people who don't have children will have pets, and they're like their children. I mean, they literally are like a family member for them. And so when we talk about understanding that space cannot be filled again, that four-legged friend or bird or whatever kind of pet it was served a purpose in our life, and a very rich purpose, and it allowed our lives to be more satisfying and more fulfilling. And when that's gone, absolutely, that loss is powerful. That loss is devastating. And to acknowledge the loss and to allow it to be what it is, to hold on to it, not ignore it, not throw it under the table or under the rug and let it just, try to go away on its own, because it won't go away on its own. And it's okay that it's painful. Does that make sense? Like, it's okay that it hurts. And then eventually, the more we let it be okay that it hurts, then it doesn't ever stop hurting, but it gets softer. And it gets a little bit more malleable. And so then more space can start opening up a little bit to maybe get another pet to fulfill the desire to have a furry friend in our life. But it's really about acknowledging the loss and letting it be okay to have that loss. It's just, I can't tell you how key that is in the healing to be able to, you know, accept and move on.
Well, we're at the point in the conversation where we're getting into the really the heart of this issue, and that's loss. I mean, there's the mechanics and mechanism of dying, death and dying, which we've been discussing, but then there's the loss. And that's kind of what it really is all about. And speak a little bit more about that.
Yeah, it is. I mean, I provide a workshop around, it's called the Sacred Circle. And what we do is we create something like you would a vision board. We create something that would represent that person that passed. So for example, when my niece passed away, she's 32, and the loss was absolutely devastating. I couldn't even breathe for the first week and a half of after her passing. I couldn't function. I couldn't, like, even going to the grocery store saying, "People, don't you understand? My niece just died. Why are you so happy? This isn't right." And acknowledging that and being able to sit in that. And what we did was we create something that's physical that would help bring that sense of loss to a place where it just gets a little bit softer. So I created this vision board around her that depicted her love of water, that depicted her love of dolphins, that showed a beautiful sunset, that I had a picture of her in the upper right-hand corner overlooking all of that, which I put on this collage. And I have that up in a special room in my home where I can just go in there and see it. And it represents her. It represents her life. It represents her love. It represents the relationship that we had together. And it just, I allow it to fulfill me in a way that's more about the love than the loss. But the loss, you know, it's a powerful emotion, and there is no barometer for determining, well, how long should I feel this loss? How long should I be grieving? You know, there isn't a formula for going, okay, well, it's been 3 weeks and 2 days, you should be done by now. There's, you know, my brother died 40 years ago, and he's still very present in my mind. And so understanding there's no timeline, there's no right or wrong way to be in the state of loss or grief, and that where you are in that moment is the exact space you're supposed to be. It is helpful for some to talk about it, you know, to join a support group, to be with others that have experienced a loss too, to know that what you're feeling is not just isolated to yourself, that you're not alone in this. Sometimes can be very, very helpful.
In my work, I found that loss is sometimes very messy. I mean, we think of it as like something we cry and we grieve and we get over it, but sometimes it's much more complicated. You talked about the experience of shock, actually. You just were kind of in disbelief and numbness for a few weeks after your niece died. By the way, I appreciate you talking about your own self. That's very vulnerable here on radio. But so there can be shock, there can be denial. You may not be ready to talk about it for a year. That's what it is, you know? And for somebody to start poking at you and prod you into that processing, it's not very caring, honestly. You may be angry. You may be angry at the person who died for dying. That doesn't make sense. But there's all kinds of emotions. I think you're right. There is no logic to it. And sometimes it takes far, far, far longer to settle down than we want it to or expect it to, and perhaps an entire life. And I just, one other thing about loss, to me, what I see helps people recalibrate is sometimes they need to withdraw a while and kind of go into a cave or a more private personal space and assess their emotions and sort it out. And this may take a while. And then after a while, they find a bigger sense of self, perhaps a larger perspective that includes the situation, which didn't make sense at all. So ultimately, I think loss can be a teacher and can lead us to an expanded experience of our heart. And we become bigger. I mean, the pain is still there. The pain may never go away, but we are wiser for it.
Well, that's beautiful, Peter. I love the way you said that. And, you know, it's very, very true what you're saying. I agree with you. I mean, it almost sounds like you're talking a little bit about Elizabeth Kubler-Ross and her five stages of death and grief, you know, and I can't rattle them off the top of my head, but I know that denial and anger are big components of that. And you're right. There is no timeline. People will process it in the way that they're able to. You know, I don't think people set out and get up in the morning and say, okay, I'm going to hold on to my loss a little bit longer. I think it's something that it's part of how they process their experience. And to, I think what's really important when someone's processing loss, whether it's today or 10 years from now, is to not judge themselves about it. Oh, I should be over this by now. Why am I still grieving? It's been 40 years. I can't believe I'm still crying. And to do that doesn't serve them. It doesn't help them with the loss. And so I would just invite people to not judge, that it's where they're at is exactly where they're supposed to be, all messy and everything, muddy and gooey and blah. And then there's days that, you know, you do function. You do see the sun shining, and it's up and down. There is no, you know, formula for how we get through it. But I do appreciate your words, Pete. That was really well said.
Thank you. Well, kind of coming out the other end of this conversation now and referring back to kind of where we started about some of the legal issues and advance directives and so forth. I used to work in the probate field. Now, so I'm dealing with inheritance issues. Somebody's already died maybe years ago. I've seen families break apart over money. And I've seen people, you know, the kindest, most generous people turn into just absolute monsters over trying to get their share or standing up for what they feel is right. And a tremendous amount of damage can happen in that realm. And I just wanted to say from my point of view that conversations in advance really helps to ease that pathway. And if everybody kind of knows where it is, it's all written down very clearly. And there's been discussions and the family can air out all of their issues. Well, but I spent time in the family business. Don't I get more money? Like, there's a lot of issues. The more it's discussed, the better the chance of the family being intact afterwards, instead of being ripped apart by these real world legal issues and money issues. Very intense, very hot. And that's kind of where we started. Like, this is the after death mechanism. Any comments about that?
Yeah, sure. You know, it really does boil down to a conversation. And that part of what, the other part of what I do besides bedside and holding space and being there with the person is to get out to the community and really educate about what it means to be prepared for end of life. And yeah, it does mean going over those grueling papers and putting stuff down. And once that is on paper, then calling a family meeting and saying, hey, this is what I want. Let's have this discussion now about what it is that I want. And then ideally, in the most perfect world, we've picked a person, a healthcare proxy or an agent that will hold fast our wishes for us, so that when push comes to shove and we're in the hospital and the machines are either going to be kept on or not, that healthcare proxy person is going to say, no, according to her wishes, she does not want to stay on that machine. And I have it right here. And so having it on paper, making a copy of it, giving it to your physician, your primary care physician, making sure that your local hospital has a copy of it on file. You have a copy of it. Your healthcare proxy has a copy of it. And I have people who will keep it they oftentimes will say, well, where is it? If you fill it out and then you don't know where it is, it's useless. So tell people where you have your healthcare information, your advanced care information, your will, your trust, because if without knowing where it is, you know, like I said, it's not going to work. Some people will keep it in their freezer. Now, I don't suggest that, but some people will keep it there because they know exactly where it is at all times. So I totally agree that we having these advanced cares ahead of time will really bring the peace of mind we're all seeking.
Lynn Ann McGrail, lastly, let's talk about what you just mentioned, education of the community. And so in the largest sense of the process of death and dying, how do we elevate this conversation and bring more awareness?
By having these kind of conversations that we're having right now.
On radio.
Yeah, absolutely. And asking questions, like not being afraid to ask questions. You know, part of my calling, part of my purpose here is, you know, doing with COVID now, everything's done by Zoom. So doing Zoom sessions with a group of people saying, okay, who here has an advanced care directive? Who here knows what it is they want to be wearing when they pass? Who here knows where they want to be when they pass? Who here knows who they want in the room with them? Do they want music playing? What do they want for their memorial? Talking about those really awkward, like, really? You're going to ask me what I want to wear? And having the conversation around it doesn't mean you're necessarily going to, you know, wear that red dress at the end of the day, but being able to just talk about it and have it be part of the conversation is just so critical. I can't even express to you how critical that is. And if people have a hard time having conversation, like if one spouse wants to talk about it and the other spouse doesn't, there is a nonprofit organization called the Conversation Project, and they offer what they call a conversation starter kit for free. It's online, and it will take you step by step how to start having that conversation. And the first conversation you really want to have the conversation with is yourself, the most important person. How are you looking at death? How are you prepared for it? And then you can talk about the conversation starter kits gives you ways to actually bring up that conversation with your spouse or your loved one. And it'll actually like give you sample sentences how to even bring it up. So it's a beautiful organization, and I, you know, invite people to go there and start having that conversation, because I know there's been a theme in everything that I talk about is talk. We're going to talk about it. Having conversations.
Lynn Ann McGrail at apeacefultransitionla.com. Thank you so much for your time. Very insightful. Let's have more of this conversation and more talk on radio about death and dying.
Thank you for having me. I really appreciate this conversation. Thank you.
Judith's Story by Mystic Pete. I have to credit my sister Judith with inspiring me as a musician. Some of my earliest memories are shooting marbles under the black Mason and Hamlin baby grand piano she played every day, Mozart's and Bach's melodies, which she practiced over and over until perfected, are deeply etched in my brain. Every time I hear Beethoven's 23rd piano sonata, the Appassionata, I think of her. Judith had a difficult life, but met obstacles head-on with her sharp intelligence and strong spirit. In her 30s, she enlisted in the Merchant Marines. Despite being in a male-dominated field, particularly in leadership positions, she worked her way up until she became an officer on a large ship, quite an accomplishment for a woman at the time. In the mid-90s, my sister Judith was tragically ill with advanced AIDS. I visited her as often as I could at the hospice to hold her hand and show her kindness. AIDS brought on a stroke, and she struggled with opportunistic diseases typical of her condition. Her head was bald, her cheeks sunken, her skin looked like gray paper, and she weighed about 90 pounds. Full-blown AIDS causes a horrible death. On one visit, late into her decline, after exhaustive procedures with tubes and needles and experimental drugs, she let down her stoic demeanor and confided in me. She had difficulty speaking due to the stroke, but motioned for me to come close and said, "I've had it. I just want to go home. I just want to go home." She had given up her apartment years earlier when she went out to sea and had come to the hospital directly from ship. I didn't know how to tell her that she had no home. A few weeks later, near the end, when my brother was visiting from out of town, we took Judith onto the patio in her wheelchair so she could enjoy the outside despite the cloudiness of the day. They hadn't seen each other in a while, so I moseyed around the patio to give my brother and Judith time to talk alone. Much to my alarm, my brother loudly told a lewd joke. How dare he be so rude with someone about to die? But then I heard it. Judith started laughing. She loved his salty wisecracks. Impending death wasn't going to stop her from enjoying a good dirty joke. I was standing behind some sort of pillar and quickly jerked myself around the obstruction because I knew I had to see her face immediately. The clouds had parted and a focused beam of sunlight was streaming down on her hairless round head. All bundled up, she looked like a Buddhist monk in the winter. And there, in the sunlight, was her wide, toothy smile with protruding canine teeth that had never known braces. Her head was thrown back and she laughed that full-bellied staccato laugh of hers that I hadn't heard in years. I got to see that wonderful image for just an instant and tried to freeze it in my mind, for I knew I would never see Judith laugh again. We are coming to the end of a show called The Mystic Pete Chronicles. Today's show on death and dying featured first a story by Mike Bone called Willis Jackson Bone. Then I interviewed Lynn Ann McGrail, who is an end-of-life doula, and wrapped it up with a story that I wrote called Judith's Story. If you'd like to reach me, I'm at mysticpete.com. Thanks so much for listening. Mystic Pete out.